Right, good morning everyone, and welcome to another EG Question Time. It's great to see so many of you here. I'm Damien Wilde, Editor-in-Chief of EG. So first, let me assure you that unlike others who've flown in from London this week, this will be an altogether more polished affair. There'll be no frantic arm-waving, no confused ruffling of hair, and I and the panel won't be conflating fact, opinion, delusion. I can assure you of that. So now we're clear on that. It's wonderful to be here in such a positive environment. And I was thinking back to last year's question time, after which my colleagues wrote, the Irish capital could be poised to benefit from the UK's imminent departure from the EU, but only if it plays its cards right. So we'll skip past imminent, and we'll come back to playing its cards right in a minute. And we'll learn more on that this morning. So build-to-rent continues to thrive. Major occupiers like WeWork and Slack are growing their footprint here, while BNY Mellon, Google and Sky are all are among the firms looking at seeking space in South Dublin amid record take-up levels in the city. And the capital story is an arresting one as well. Investment into the market hit €1.9 billion during the first 6 months of the year, an impressive figure. So what's driving these inflows? Can they be sustained? We'll talk about that too this morning. So I'll introduce our panel in just a moment, but first a quick reminder of how this works. Some of you have pre-submitted questions. I'll come to some of you this morning. Thank you for those, so stay poised. If you want to make a point, interrogate our panel, disagree hopefully with some of the things that they say in panel, please feel free to disagree with each other. I'll positively encourage that. You can do it in the old-fashioned way and raise your hand and a microphone will come and find you. Or if you get your phones out now and go on to Slido, slido.com, and use the hashtag EGQT, details up on the screen, you can ask questions that way as well. Anonymously, if you want, please use that feature with care. You can also like questions so they rise to the top and ensure that a question that you see does get asked. And if you're tweeting about the event, use the same hashtag, EGQT. Right, to our panel. Closest to me is Arlene Van Bosch, Development Director at UNI. Next to her is Orla Hegarty, Architect and Assistant Professor at the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy at University College Dublin. In the centre is Roland O'Connell, Chairman of Savills. Next to him is James Partiger, Senior Director of Projects at Greystar Europe. And last but by no means least is Patrick Phelan, Group Corporate Finance Director at Ballymore. And with a panel like that, I'm sure we're going to resolve all of the issues at hand over the next 50 minutes or so. So let's start with that line from last year, that if over the next 12 months Dublin plays its cards right, it can thrive as the environment continues to evolve. Arlene, is Dublin playing its cards right now?
I think so. I think that we need to be very careful and see what type of a place we want Dublin to become. I think that we need to look at how regeneration can focus and shape the type of communities that we bring forward within Dublin. It's very important that we protect our cultural heritage and history here as well. So we need to look at really embracing and in taking an inclusive approach, I would say, towards any regeneration policies that we do bring forward in Dublin.
And to achieve that, it requires all sorts of different groups, public and private sector, community to pull together. Is that happening as well?
Yeah, I mean, we focus quite heavily at UNI on proper engagement. So engagement from day one, grassroots approach, learning from the local communities where we are based. So normally we base ourselves and immerse ourselves in, right in the middle of that. There's lots of things that we can learn from the local communities that perhaps we wouldn't know as a developer, not being entirely local. You know, obviously we are a UK-based firm, but we have a presence here in Ireland as well. So a lot of that does enrich the design process. It makes sure as well that we're not parachuting sort of weird or foreign uses in that just don't sit well within the existing culture and local community as well. So we just need to be careful about what kind of place we want to shape Dublin as, and we need to make it very attractive for, you know, more inward investment, but we need to do that carefully so that we protect what's actually really special about us.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back to the sort of city we, all of you, perhaps the audience as well, want Dublin to be. But Orla, going back to that central question, is Dublin playing its cards right now?
I'm not sure, actually. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about it. And from a development and investment point of view, I think we need a level of certainty. And what we have is uncertainty about Brexit, obviously. We have uncertainty about the construction industry and the sort of cost base we're working off and the capacity of the construction industry. And we've had a lot of policy change in a short space of time over 3 or 4 years, which I think has also maybe added risk inadvertently when it was about maybe trying to solve other problems. It probably has put a bit more risk into the equation. And we're seeing some of that play out in repeat planning applications and uncertainty about development opportunities on site. So whereas we had quite a stable system, I think, within the development plan of opportunities on site, that has been disrupted somewhat. So all of this is about risk and reward, really. You can quantify the reward on paper, and you have to do a bit of risk assessment around that. And I think the risk assessment is a really difficult part at the moment. There are a lot of things in the mix about making that stack up.
And even putting Brexit to one side, is it a risky environment these days, and it has been?
Well, I think the development model that we are used to here, which was a speculative development procurement, the conditions for that have changed considerably since what it was 15 years ago when everything took off and we had cheap labour and cheaper credit and cheaper land. We're in a very different environment now, and people who are in that sector will know that labour is not cheap and readily available. Land has become a bigger challenge, and finance has become a much bigger challenge. So it's a very different business to what it was previously, and some of the new players maybe don't have the legacy experience that some of the older players, like maybe the Ballymores or whatever, would have in terms of knowing the market and knowing their own sector.
Okay, thank you. And Roland, you were nodding there. Do you share Ola's assessment of that, of the environment?
I do, but I have a problem with the question, because you're asking, you know, what's going to happen over the next year, and that kind of sums up the problem with Dublin. We think in far too...
Shall I ask 5 years? Would 5 years be a better question?
Well, maybe even a 10-year plan, but we recently had a couple of referendums here, or referendi, depending what you want to call them, and prior to that, we had citizens' assemblies that debated the issues, and then it went to the Dáil, where there were was further debate about these things, and then we had a referendum about them. So there could have been a pointer there to you about Brexit, but that's another day's work. But one of the hottest topics in Ireland at the moment is housing, and we've got people chirping in with all sorts of views about what's good and bad and what should and shouldn't be done. And sometimes, I'm sure, and a lot of the time, that's heartfelt and well-intended, but a lot of the time it's also plain wrong and has counterproductive effects. And I think that on something like housing and like the future of the city, having a larger, big debate about what we want to see in the city in the future, how we want to provide housing in the country, and take it away from the kind of hot political argument where people are trying to score points, but to look at a longer-term view of life and what we'd like to see achieved would be a very, very healthy thing for the city and for the country as a whole. And I think until we get to that longer-term cross-party view of what we want to achieve, we're going to have problems in the city and in the country as a whole. In broad terms, though, I think the city is doing very well. There's plenty of hope for the future. There's probably... in international terms, more uncertainty than we've ever seen. And we are very much an international trading country. And so the future of the country and the city depends on what happens internationally. And we have very little influence over that.
So I like the idea of a mature, nuanced political debate. It feels kind of out of step with these times. In very many countries, let's broaden it.
So who should
who should lead that? Does that come from you, from the sorts of people who are on the panel here, or does it come from a local authority or a central government?
Yeah, well, I think it's a local authority or central government, but I think it should include every... stakeholder or every interest group within the city. So the ordinary citizen with no axe to grind, representative groups, people with professional experience of developing or designing, all of these people coming together, because I think by they explaining to each other what the difficulties are, what the concerns are, you are then more likely in a cool environment like that to come up with sensible solutions that will work for everybody.
And the time frame should be 10 years or longer.
Well, yeah, it would be great if it could be done more quickly, but anybody involved in property knows that property and property development is a very long-term process. And again, you know, listening to political debate in Ireland, they want instant solutions to our housing problems, they want instant solutions to everything, but you don't get instant solutions to property, so we have to be realistic and plan long-term and take that on board. I think also central government could help by being a bit more adventurous with infrastructure and actually going ahead and spending money on infrastructure that encourages good behaviour in terms of future development, rather than allowing the infrastructure to follow the development, which is what has happened to date. And again, that has led to bad development and development in places where it shouldn't have happened.
Okay, thank you. And James, that question again, is Dublin playing its cards right? And I wonder if you could bring an international perspective as well. You're active in a number of markets internationally. Does this feel like a sensible, forward-looking city compared to some others?
It certainly seems to be. And I, of the panellists, I probably have one here with the least sort of local knowledge. But what I would say is that Dublin is clearly a growing city. It's a global city. It's got a lot of growth happening into it, but it's not unique in that. There are other places, and it's got echoes of, when the London Docklands started to be transformed 30 plus years ago. Parts of it. And I think that is good in many ways, but it has to be treated with care. Although I'm obviously here as a representative of Greystar, and we're the global leader in rental housing. I am kind of pro-housing generally. People will need places to live, and we're here to talk about build-to-rent today, but we probably need more homes for sale and also affordable and social housing as well to cover the whole spectrum. And I think one of the things that has been missing from, not just from this city probably, but certainly London and other places around the world, is this sort of increasing polarisation of housing, which is why it's become such a political issue, where the for sale and the affordable have been the two ends of the spectrum, but the people in the middle have had nothing specific provided for them at all, for the people who can't access either end of that spectrum, or who don't want to buy even if they could afford it, because they see increasing change in their career patterns or geographical location, and we've got to cater for that. So it's about finding out what people actually need out of the buildings that we build, not just now, but into the future, and certainly not what was needed 40 years ago, and trying to sort of catch up with where we should have been before, because that's gone. We've got to look forward and respond to what people want now, and provide that.
And when Greystar looks at cities it might invest in, it must have a number of boxes that need to be ticked. Is Dublin right in the sweet spot? Is it a priority city?
Yeah, I think absolutely. It's a growing city. It's a global business city. We've got a rental population of about 25% of people in Dublin currently rent, but that rental sector is at full capacity. There is an increasing demand for more of that, and probably of a reliable and good quality product, which we know we can provide, because that's what we've been doing for 30 years. I think there is, it may not suit everybody, but it suits a real part of the market, which I've just explained, that's been ignored for a long time, but is definitely growing.
Okay, thank you. And Patrick, difficult going last, so reframing the question slightly, what would it take to make Dublin more of a priority for Ballymore? What would you like to see to persuade you to invest more significantly here?
Well, I think we have over the last number of years. Ballymore has always had a presence here in relation to our house building operation. I think what people may have seen in the last few years is our investment in the Dublin Landings on the North Docks. And I think if you take a step back and look and stand in 2014 at what's now the central building and look north at the docks, it was a pretty barren, windy spot. And international capital and its partnering with developers such as ourselves and Johnny Ronan and various different people, that whole space has now been transformed. And I think it's a credit to Dublin, the planners, the funders, the developers, in some regard we don't get a lot of credit for it, have brought along an amazing, pretty amazing space there. And it's been a combination of the creation of really good placemaking and design, some of it learned by ourselves and different developers in the international space. So we've taken a lot of the experience that we've gained in London and in Central Europe and brought that back to Dublin. And I think if you were to ask me, my day job, and I work between London and Dublin simply because of where we have most of our assets, is to sell those locations. And so when I'm traveling around the world talking to international capital, and it is international capital, you know, I would start with our Manchester, Liverpool, our Central Europe stuff and some of our estate stuff. But then when I mention Dublin, everybody's eyes lights up. And they want to invest in Dublin. And, you know, we shouldn't forget to a pension fund in Korea or a Canadian pension fund. You know, Ireland is a small place, and yet these people have put their faith in the country. So to me, to answer your first question, is Dublin is absolutely, from a macro perspective, getting it right. I understand, and as Orla said, you know, there are some micro issues which we need to deal with, but I believe we're always going to have those, and we have at least got the weight of capital behind us, and it is that capital that's needed to make the city continue to be great.
Okay, thank you. And Orla, there were a couple of points from the panellists about design and its appeal, particularly from Patrick there. Is Dublin getting that right?
I think we have, we have some really, really good aspects. We have a largely intact historic city, which has a very human scale, and in comparison to a lot of other cities, is a very pleasant place to be, and has grown very well and has grown incrementally. I think you need to travel sometimes to come back to appreciate the benefits of it. We have areas of dereliction as well. We have areas, substantial areas, particularly in the north inner city, of under-occupancy, where there's a lot of potential for both housing and for development, maybe in a more incremental way. I would agree with the point about the alignment of what we're trying to achieve here. And I think, actually, there's a very broad growing consensus about a lot of this. I speak in a lot of different places, there's obviously, I have a foot in the property side and a foot in the construction side and in the design side and in housing policy and the kind of social end of that. I think there's a very broad growing consensus about affordability and housing being absolutely key to the city, and about how that is achieved. And I think if we start with fact rather than different shades of opinion, I think it's all solvable, actually. It doesn't have to be as contentious as some of our recent referendums. I think there's a very broad consensus now about what that needs to be and about how our competitiveness is really intrinsically linked to having good housing and to having it in locations where people can easily get to work and they're not commuting long distances, which tends to push parents particularly out of the employment market, aside from all of the other, you know, disadvantages of people spending a lot of time in cars. So I think there is a lot of consensus around that, but I think we're missing the piece about urban housing for families and long-term communities. I think that piece is being missed. We're dealing with the workers, particularly in the tech sector, who need quality housing in the city and close to work. And we're dealing with some of the issues for student population, particularly the international students, and we're dealing with the hotel side for the tourists. I think we're missing the bit about the people who actually will drive the buses and serve the coffees and be nurses in the hospitals and all of those people. That piece of the housing market is being missed in the city, and there are plenty of opportunities. So I think, you know, just to go back to some of the commentary,
Do you mind me asking, in terms of design or cost?
I think in terms of it, of obviously development finance will follow the best option on the site. Mm. And the balance has been skewed in favour of some of the competing interests, you know, missing the point that development money will follow the best option. And at the moment, that kind of longer-term stable housing has been squeezed out by other alternatives.
Sorry, just one second, Patrick. Is there enough focus on build for sale, or is there too much on build to rent? Because the sorts of people you're talking about may well have aspirations to own rather than rent.
I don't think we're going to see any build to sell apartments in the short term. The alternatives are so much better for developers.
That's a problem for the people of the city.
I think it's a very serious problem. We also have a legacy of quality issues, I think, that we need to be much more upfront about. there's a large sector of the population who would be very reluctant to buy an apartment because of historic quality issues and construction quality issues, and people are nervous about that because they're seeing what's happened previously. I also wonder, because the build to rent standards are lower standards now than the build for sale since the beginning of last year, just keeping an eye on future asset values, if you build, you know, small units in build to rent blocks, will they hold their value? And are you reducing your options about sale in the future if you go down that road as an investor?
Okay, thank you. Patrick.
I was just going to say, in relation to the build to sell, I mean, if you look at how an apartment development comes together, and for us in Ballymore, you know, we've looked at a couple of different sites in both London and Dublin and how to fund them. And the reality at the moment is that the build to sell offers us at least the ability to construct those apartments and bring them into the market. The build to rent model allows us to go to an institutional investor to either pre-sell the entire block or to pre-fund the entire block. If we do the build to sell model, you know, if I approach the banks, to be fair to them, they say, look, you need to pre-sell the units. Now, we're 2, 3, 4 years out from the PC of those units. And the mortgage market is just not there. So even if people want to buy those apartments because, you know, they recognise the quality and taking aside the cost, they just can't. So without institutional investment through the buy-to-rent model at this moment in time in Dublin, and indeed, it's not just a Dublin problem. We see similar issues in London. It's really, really difficult to get development off the ground for apartments. Housing is different, and I think we do need to define the problem correctly. So what we really have is an apartment supply problem, particularly in Dublin. Houses, we have a lot of houses in Dublin already, if you look at the ratios. I think someone told me there's like it's a 75-25 split between houses and apartments. What we need to do is to get apartment development off the ground, and at this juncture, the only way to do that, apart from one or two high-end schemes, is through the institutional investment market.
How you have to fund and pre-sell apartments. Do you find that if it's 3-4 years out that you're then having to go to more of the investor market? So you're back then to square one in terms of you've got another rented product rather than, you know, something where it's an owner-occupier. Just looking around issues around transients as well, and when we're trying to build sustainable communities, it's quite a challenge for us because we're having to take risks very early on in the process. So that does, you know, have impacts on deliverability of schemes. I think, Orla, you're right as well, what you said about, or maybe it was you, about bringing forward build-to-rent schemes. Typically, they can be delivered within, you know, 3 to 4 years if you're looking at a 100 or a 1,000 unit scheme. It could take up to 10 years to deliver that on the build-to-sell market. So if we're to solve the housing crisis in the short term, you know, we need more innovative solutions, and design is probably one of those. But it's having a mix of products in the market. I don't think that it's build-to-sell or build-to-rent. It's fit-for-purpose housing. You know, there is a place for co-living. There's a place for compact living, student accommodation, build-to-rent, you know, the semi-detached in the suburbs. There's a place for all of that, but we need to look at where and what the right location is for the right product.
It sounds like the nature of supply isn't being determined by the market demand, or even planners, but by the nature of the financing market. Mm. What can be funded? Is that the case?
These are very sophisticated investors, many of them in the room. They know that there is a structural supply problem in many of the great cities of the world, and it's not going to fix itself anytime soon. So there's a real opportunity there for the rental model and institutional capital to partner together, you know, because they get a return. I think Orla mentioned, and we do need to be careful as well in relation to defining buy-to-rent. Yes, some of the initial schemes we've seen have been towards the higher end. So there's undoubtedly a viability issue. You need rents north of a number to make the whole thing viable. But any of the buy-to-rent investors that I've met, their actual focus is on the mid-level market, which is a lot broader and, in their view, much more sustainable. So I think if we can solve the cost issue, and costs are rising, so this is a problem we're against the tide, certainly if Ballymore could bring forward a mid-market rent model, well-connected, on a good line, I'd have no problem that we would actually have a tighter yield than we would with some of our high-end product, because the investors themselves see that as a long-term, more probably potentially stable product into the 20 to 25 year horizon, which many of them have.
Okay, all of them.
I would agree with you about the mid-market, and I think it is achievable, and I think that's a design and a procurement challenge actually more than anything else. If you're looking at some of the figures that were published last week, if half of the price of delivery or half of the sales cost is the process of delivery, there's something wrong with the delivery model, not something wrong with the product, because if you're paying twice for the product just through the process of delivery, I think that's the problem. I would also question, we've had a lot of commentary around apartments versus houses, and I think a lot of it is not what you've said, but a lot of it is very simplistic, and people are equating apartment with small homes and house with big homes, and we've been hearing things about, well, we have enough houses. We don't have a political economy that redistributes houses, so we're not going to start evicting every widower on the south side who has a 3-bed and a garden and a dog because there's a family somewhere else that needs it. People will make choices, and people always choose more space. The reason we have a big commuter belt is that people need space, and people will move house for an extra bedroom or a larger kitchen. So I think the market is missing that. I mean, it's talking about apartments when actually it shouldn't use that word. It should be talking about more dense housing. And the idea that we only need 1 and 2 bedroom apartments, I think, is a really serious flaw in some of the thinking. I mentioned the North Inner City earlier. Half of the homes in the North Inner City only have 1 bedroom. Now, to think that we will make sustainable communities there by building more student housing and more 1-bedroom built to rents, I think is a mistake. You're actually making a community that people will not want to live in, where it's very transient and the streets aren't safe and the people who live there don't have enough money to support the services and good schools and everything else. The only way you will make that as an investment, if you have a building there, you want the whole area to come up and you want it to be a place where people actively choose to live rather than find a rental there. And the only way you will do that actually is by having a more diverse community and people who put down roots longer term, and I think that really badly needs larger units in a lot of areas.
Okay, Arlene quickly, sorry, then Roland, then I'll bring in the audience.
Sorry, I think just picking up on the comment that Orla made about diversity as well, you know, we are in danger of, you know, the San Fran effect here, especially with the larger tech industries. You know, that there's a price point there, and what we find then is that local people are getting priced out of the market, which means that, you know, we have less culturally diverse areas within Dublin's inner city in particular, I would say. So we're forcing local people and communities out, which means that there is that loss of identity, and we need to work harder together as property professionals, along with central government and Dublin City Council as well, to try and make sure that we don't allow that to continue. Part of that will be looking at mixed-use development. It's perhaps not the right option to deliver private rented sector or build-to-rent in isolation. They have to be part of mixed-use developments where I think the trends are changing. You know, people do want to live, work and play in the one area. It's all about convenience, access. They want to be able to walk 5 minutes to a restaurant now. And I think that, you know, we look at there is generation rent, but that doesn't mean that it's solely 19 to 25 year olds or 19 to 35 year olds. It's throughout the life cycle. Now we just need to look at the right products for the right people in the right location, and maintain that sense of identity as well.
Okay, thank you. Just before Roland and James come in, Peter Levins has a question. If the microphone could find its way to Peter on the front row, just down here. Roland?
Issue. I think that the two things, number one, everybody has a fear of change, but there seems to be a huge fear of change in terms of city. I don't think we should be worried about that. You know, it used to be that Henrietta Street, Mountjoy Square were the most prestigious parts of the city. Southside was a kip, it all changes. South Great Georgia Street used to be the main shopping street, it's no longer, but it's changed into a different thing. We shouldn't be worried about change in the city. Change is a good thing as well as a bad thing. So we shouldn't try to preserve everything and say it's perfect the way it is. So change is good. Bigger units, I don't think, are the solution to people and families living in the city. The things that families want in the city are safe parks for the kids to play in. They want good schools. They want safe streets to walk around and things like that. It doesn't matter if the the apartments or houses are four-bedroom or two-bedroom, those things are much more important. So unless...
I'm not sure all families would agree
with
that.
Well, look, unless we lead with getting the things like the parks and the schools and the safe streets, we're not going to end up with families living on a long-term basis in some of the areas that we'd like to see redeveloped. So we need to recognise that and be brave about it. We had a situation in the last boom where there were lots of three-bedroom apartments built, and they were always the most difficult to sell. And they were subsequently, quite often, not the most difficult to let because you got lots of students in or young people who were just starting to work or whatever, quite happy to share them. But generally, they were never bought by families. So there's a reason for that, and I think the reason is the environment as opposed to the size of the unit.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, I can just add to that. I think there is, I think evidence we've got is that families typically would prefer a house to an apartment anyway. So if you're building it, you know, in the city centre, it's very hard to build new, straightforward, normal houses, certainly at anywhere near, reasonable prices. But I think evidence also shows that for a rental model, not only are you delivering homes faster, but when people buy, they tend to, if they can afford it, they buy an extra bedroom more than they need before future expansion or whatever. But actually, when they're renting, they just rent the space they need. So in the Mayor of London, for example, has produced some really interesting statistics on this. So 45% of owner-occupied homes are under-occupied in the sense that there is a spare room, or at least one spare room. In the rental sector, that's down under 5%. Because people know that if they're in a building like, the sort of things we're developing, if you run out of space, you need another room, you can just move to a larger apartment in the same development and still stay part of that community. That's not transience. That's actually allowing people to flex their circumstances and stay in the same place. Yes, of course, there have to be some. But the other point is that in the three-bedroom apartments, we as well as being difficult to sell, we find those quite difficult to rent. And they tend to be to sharers rather than families. There may be some various reasons behind that. But I think there is a sort of a myth that everyone starts in a small unit and then gradually works their way up to a large unit. Some people actually start in a large unit sharing with friends when they can afford it, when they feel that actually that period of their social life has come to a natural end, they will go to their own space.
Patrick, I'll come back to you in a moment. I want to take Peter's question.
Thank you, Damien. Just an open question to the panel. Do you think the four individual county councils could be doing more to promote redevelopment of Z6 and Regen zone sites across the city at present?
Thank you. We're half an hour in and we haven't blamed the planners yet. Patrick?
Yeah, like Z6, so for us, taking a step back, the SHD planning system is working for the development community, certainly on our side, because it provides us with much more certainty. I think one of the issues with it is, though, the Z6, you only can get an SHD, it's 4,500 square metres, I think. So that is an issue for us that we've found in the Z6. We have an excellent site out in Royal Canal Park where we're developing over 400 units. And one of the biggest issues we've had is around that provision. We're in the SHD process, but what happens with the employment use? So I think if there's one thing that needs to be looked at, it's just that particular, how do you handle the employment use within a development? Other than that, our general assessment is that the planning community is pretty responsive to the needs of bringing more supply into the market at the moment.
Sorry, just a second, Arlene. Peter, do you ask that question because you think they should do more?
Well, I work in the industrial and logistics space, so for me, I'm interested to know how is industrial space going to play a part in delivering new supply, and how quickly can it do it? We talk about speed, and everyone talks about city centre and inner city centre, but should the focus be looking more at the older industrial estates that really are moving to obsolescence much more quickly than we really think? And there's vast tracts of land across those four county councils that are able to deliver that in a very timely fashion, in my view. I don't feel the four county councils are doing enough to support private development. You find that individuals may be buying sites or compiling sites, but then they're being asked to master plan with their next door neighbours. Should the county councils be taking a more proactive role in that process?
Thank you, Arlene.
Make moves towards that. Definitely there's a lot of risk for developers in having to master plan and work with neighbours because there's a lot of financial uncertainty about land prices and partnership in that. So I think they are making moves towards that, but they could probably do more. And I think that they will. I think that that shift will come. I don't know the timescale for that. It's very hard to say, but you know, we'd hope that by sort of 2-3 years' time it'll be a very different story.
And Roland, we've seen this debate in other cities and we've seen it perhaps go too far in London, and there's been protection of industrial land, industrial sites. But do you think it can go further within those four local authorities?
Yeah, no, I think it can, but there are difficulties because, as Peter alluded to, there are different ownerships within, let's say, a bigger industrial estate. And it's very hard for a resi developer to go in and build an apartment block in the middle of run-down industrial units and expect that it's going to be attractive to buyers or renters. So I think getting a coordinated approach is something that the councils can definitely help with. And maybe even in some circumstances, they may need to use their CPO powers to facilitate proper development of these, because there has to be a comprehensive plan, as everybody's alluded to. But I think, again, infrastructure is an issue with these, and you know, whether it's bus services, rail services, those sort of things that need to be provided as well to make these viable for residential development is important.
Ola.
I would agree on that. I think master planning from the local authority level and that being resourced and advanced is really, really important. otherwise, what we will see is piecemeal development where nobody gains really because they're all compromised sites. You've got road layouts that were a truck turning circle in 1965, and you've got new communities moving in. You don't have amenity space. We see that a bit in Sandyford, where it badly needs a bit of greenery and a bit of park space for communities. So I think there has to be a lead where if you're trying to get it right in the long term, and these are large sites, it's too risky for any investor to take that scale of site, and it would probably take 30 years. The lead has to come from the local authority, which effectively de-risks development. So it will involve CPOs, I think. It will involve master planning. It will involve negotiation with landowners, either to buy them out or to compromise and give them new sites within CPO development or whatever else. Everybody will gain from that. Absolutely everybody would gain because you would have incremental development that is in a phased way that makes sense, and the end product will be so much better because it's been designed on paper rather than a kind of haphazard mishmash of things on different sites.
Okay, we'll stick with planning for a bit and housing for a bit longer. Most of the questions that came through beforehand were on housing. I do want to take it in other directions, so get your questions in. But Vince Harney had a question as well. Vince, are you here? Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Damien. Hi, everybody. The question was basically, will Dublin City Council open up to proven BTR and PRS models for the inner city?
And that overlaps with another question which came in earlier, which was, what are your views on high-rise commercial and residential prospects in Dublin City? Is the city adequately geared to accommodate high-rise and the impact of this density? James?
Yes, I mean, we're trying to balance a number of things here. Land is a certain price, construction costs are a certain price, and you need to keep the rents within affordable ranges. And so that, therefore, does dictate, really, sometimes the density of and the size of your developments. I mean, personally, for Greystar, we have an on-site management team on all of our developments, so that really means we need to have at least, say, 250 or so homes in the same building or development, which is quite dense, and it may not suit every single location, but that's the service we want to provide, and it's that ongoing operation and management of these buildings, which is really a very key factor for us. in some locations, of course, that will mean high-rise. In other locations, it can mean more sort of mid-rise and out in the countryside. It might be very conventional, affordable housing in due course. I think we're starting with cities first, obviously, and that clearly has a tendency to create high-rise. I mean, Dublin Landings, for example, we're up to 10 stories. In London, we've got some down, some which we're delivering at sort of 6 or 7 stories in the majority. And we've got, in the other extreme, we've got the world's tallest modular tower in Croydon, which is going up to 44 stories. That's a very compact site. And that's, so it is varied in terms of how appropriate that is for Dublin. Clearly, it is not a high-rise city at the moment. Looking across the city, it is low to mid rise. It's a question of adapting. Realizing is that change required? How do we accommodate that change, and how do we get everyone comfortable with the change? But it is about the infrastructure. It's about how do you provide a lot more people. How do we provide additional medical, educational, and other support services in the community? And how do we tie in as our managed communities? How do we tie in and interact with that?
Roland, it sounds like that's not going to happen, given developer financial models and the council's understandable desire to keep it a livable city. It's going to happen further out, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. We're gas in Ireland because we're fascinated by history, and but we never seem to learn the lessons from history. And I think the Docklands is a fantastic example. Everybody accepted that the initial phases of development in the Docklands, the IFSC 1 and 2, were too uniform in height. They were kind of boring looking and whatever. So we then had the SDZ developed for the second phase of Docklands. We had a recession, during which time we had loads of time to think about what we wanted for our city, but we didn't think about it at all. We ignored it. And then we came up with this SDZ that was a continuation of the building heights and models that we'd had already. And in an area where there was no indigenous population, where you could afford to go higher, we didn't take that opportunity, and it was a hugely missed opportunity. And I think that we should all be kicking ourselves continuously about that. On the other hand, I'm not a fan of high-rise per se, and I think, again, a lot of the developers do themselves a disservice by talking about high-rise in Ireland, because people think of Manhattan and they say, ooh, I don't like the sound of that. And I certainly wouldn't like the idea of that in Dublin. But I think there are certain points around the city where higher rise buildings would be appropriate. And I think that in places like the South Docklands, that we could have gone up to 10, 11, 12 stories in certain locations, which isn't high rise by any stretch of imagination, which wouldn't have had a detrimental effect on the city, but in actual fact would have had a positive effect. I think recently we're seeing the prospect of this whole thing getting away from the planners, and that we may very well end up with higher rise buildings in inappropriate locations in the city that will interfere with the Georgian heritage and the things that we're proud of in the city. So I think...
You expect mistakes to be made?
I think mistakes are being or about to be made, as the case may be. And I think it's quite likely we'll see more of those unless there's a recognition that there needs to be more flexibility and more thought about this. But certainly high rise in the internationally known term, I wouldn't like to see in Dublin anywhere, really. Mid rise, yes. High rise, no.
Okay, thank you. We've got a couple of questions come in on our side. I'll deal with the first one quickly, which has been there for a little while, directed at Roland. Could 3-bedroom apartments be more appealing to families with improved design features, storage, balconies, kitchen and living space?
Yes, is the answer to that. Of course, it'd be more appealing to anybody, whether they're families or not, but it comes back to everything else. If you build the most beautiful apartment in a location where you're terrified to go outside the front door, it's not going to be attractive to families. And secondly, if you build the most beautiful apartment at a price that no family can afford is not going to be attractive to families. So there's a balance in all of these things, but you know, the smart answer to that is yes.
Patrick, is that difficult to do within the price that the market's willing to pay?
I think if you take our London example, we in London City Island, which is the one in near Canning Town, if anybody's been in London, we, by the Newham Council, we were encouraged to provide more family-type units. And, you know, I think it's wrong to think that families don't live in London and they're living in places like City Island. You know, they're not living on Canary Wharf, but they're living 15, 20 minutes away on the tube and having a great lifestyle. I think the key is to create a community. And it can be a little bit of a cliche, but if you look certainly at what our guys are trying to achieve with City Island, Embassy Gardens, we've just launched our project in Brentford. It's all about the communities, the amenities, the retail provision, and I think, and Ron's right, security. That is what families respond to. So, you know, they start off, we make sure we have a lot of 2+1 type units, some 3 beds, and the key is to have a mix. So just like the buy-to-rent offer where people start with a 1-bed, 2-bed, our experience in Ballymore is that they don't then want to leave that community because their friends are there, they've established roots. What they want is a mix of offerings. So, you know, you want maybe 10%, maybe less of these larger 3 beds just to accommodate those families.
Okay, thank you. I promised to take questions from the floor and haven't asked yet. Are there any questions out there? Or are you embracing Slido? We're dealing with everything they want to know. Let's move slightly, because I promised to talk about more than residential, into mixed use. And Arlene, this one for you. What measures are developers taking to ensure their developments connect with neighbouring communities, avoiding that disconnect which we hear so much about?
Yeah, I think the first thing is day one, get out there. Go walk the streets, go talk to the person who sells eggs or bread in the local shop. Find out what's important to local retailers, to local residents.
Is this the rest of your morning that you're describing?
Yeah, it can be. It depends what day of the week it is. But we've done that really successfully, you know, in inner city parts of London as well. You know, there were derelict sites that were sort of boarded up. We opened them up. We took the hoardings down. We put in placemaking, created a worthwhile use. And that really welcomes people in, so you can start to engage and consult properly. You start to get into the nitty-gritty then of what's needed in the area, what you can bring and how you marry it more effectively with what's already there. So that you start to cause a regeneration effect, not just for that site, but one that has a ripple effect. And that's probably, you know, how you get very successful regeneration initiatives in certain areas. As I said earlier, you cannot parachute in some random use that just doesn't sit very well with the locals. People need somewhere where they can go and buy a loaf of bread for a euro. They don't want to have to buy a sourdough for 5 euro. You know, have to make sure that you're providing amenities for everyone, locals and new residents as well. You also need to make sure that you're fully committed to that engagement process. So it doesn't just, it's not a tick box exercise for planning. It does definitely help your planning application process. But I think what we have to learn as developers is it actually enriches and starts to build that community. So you're then able to maybe set up mixed-use developments in less established locations. So include office provision perhaps in areas that wouldn't typically be an office location. And you're starting to look then at the covenant and the value is in the area and not necessarily in the occupier. Of an office where you're looking at, you know, that as part of a mixed use development. And then that leads to, you know, the community where people want to live, they want to work, they want to have dinner in the restaurant downstairs. So it's making sure that you're providing that full range of activity and amenity on site. And then picking up on the points that were raised earlier, provision of infrastructure, supporting infrastructure, schools are very important, childcare, hospital provision. And public transport, I think that there needs to be more infrastructure and more investment in public transport as well, just to help people to commute more easily in a more sustainable way. There's so much reliance on the car in Dublin, and I find that particularly coming from the London environment. I'm still staggered by the amount of people that drive to work. So if we can create places where people can easily walk, cycle, it just creates a better place, really.
And difficult to talk about a project like Guinness or other projects that are imminent in the city, but is it easier to get a community to identify with a mixed-use project than purely a residential project, say, if there is that prospect of employment and leisure activities?
I think in my experience, yes. I might want to check in with Patrick as well.
There's nodding.
I think, yes, you know, if you're providing that range of facilities, you know, you can't be everything to everyone. We're not going to solve the housing crisis on one site. And I think it's very important. But if we keep making these, you know, these gestures and keep at the forefront of our mind that we have to bring forward these sustainable communities. You know, we want long-lasting communities. We want people to have a sense of ownership. You know, when we're creating public spaces that sort of, they're the fabric that knits everything together. Who ultimately has ownership of those places is actually the public, because they're the people that use it. So we need to invest properly in that. If people can't afford to go into a restaurant or cafe, create a space where they can sit outside. They can bring their own coffee. You know, they're still able to take part in that activity rather than feeling isolated. And, you know, and that's when you start to get connotations of gentrification. You know,
I was that, coming to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that they're being excluded. I think you've got to make sure that it's a fully inclusive design. And it's just the small, careful thought that you put into your public realm, your fabric, you know, your public seating. Have you got free events? Can you create the space more effectively so that you're welcoming in, you know, a broader range of people? You're being more inclusive. You've got better social and cultural diversity in that way as well. That's what leads to successful regeneration, in our opinion.
Thank you, Orla. The second half of that question is, how do the panel feel about the word gentrification? There are developers doing positive engagement. Not all are, I'm sure. Are communities believing of developers' sincerity, or are they more suspicious these days?
I don't think there's anything wrong with gentrification. I think what we're talking about here is very rapid gentrification, which can feel like displacement and can feel like a disruptor to a community. I mean, our longer-term planning objectives in Ireland 2040 are for more dense urban communities and for more compact growth and less sprawl, and there's, I think, 100% agreement on that. And yet we have city communities who've already bought in to living in cities for several generations and who have local schools and everything, and they're being displaced. So the very thing we're trying to create as a longer-term planning objective is actually being undermined sometimes by shorter-term development strategies. So I think we need to support the communities who are already there. And gentrification development is all good. If we were here 100 years ago, we would be shocked at the dirt and the the poverty and the deprivation in the part of the city and most of it that we're sitting in. So gentrification and development is all very good, but it has to be managed, or we will have other. What we'll end up with is you end up having an economic gain on a development in the development sector and an economic loss to the exchequer and an environmental and social cost as well. So I think we do need to promote it, but we need to be careful. Everything that's been said here this morning actually is about very strong urban principles of community and settled communities and new areas that people actually actively choose to live in. And sometimes we talk about housing in isolation. We should really just be talking about housing communities, because the resistance, whether it's in an inner city community where there's a big student housing citadel or whether it's in a suburban community where you can't get a train in the morning or you can't get a place on the soccer team and you can't get into a creche, it's the strain on services that support community that causes resistance to development. It's normally not the development itself. It's the fact that the infrastructure and the social infrastructure and the educational infrastructure and everything else is going to be spread more thinly for the existing population that causes the resistance. So when Roland talked about infrastructure investment, it needs to be a very broad interpretation of infrastructure, not just Irish Water and roundabouts. Yeah. It needs to be the amenity space, the school provision. And we need to maybe sweat the infrastructure we have a bit better. There are lots of parts of the city and regional towns that have capacity in their infrastructure where we could be developing first without having to provide very expensive infrastructure, rather than going to the periphery and putting in very expensive heavy engineering to open up land for new communities when actually we have capacity in other places.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes left and we've got a lot of questions that are now flooding in, and they're quite difficult as well. Patrick, very, very quickly.
I think there's one other element here. I think there has to be, and we talk about trust. I think for Ballymore, if you look, when we acquire a site, we take it cradle to grave. And I think the guy who negotiates the bakery, who gets the planning, they need to be the people that are there at the end. And indeed, we have an estate management function. So we're on some of our estates for 20, 25 years, and we don't sell, you know, the land in any way. We take it all the way through. That gives comfort to the community, to the planners, and indeed, it builds that trust level. So, you know, Sean, our chairman, takes a huge amount of time to walk the community. If he tells someone that this is going to happen, they know it's going to happen, and they know it's going to be us that's doing it. So that's really important, I think, for the community as well.
Can I just echo that? Our sort of largest scheme, which is currently under development, is at Greenford in West London. It actually sort of encapsulates all the sort of principles of what we're trying to do. And I think when we first took that to public consultation, there was a lot of pushback. Oh, we know what you're going to do. You're just going to build this up. You know, go off with your profits and you know, leave us with all the problems. And we, you know, said no, because we're managing this into the long term. We have people here. If you can foresee problems with, you know, some of the road layouts and that sort of thing, you know, we had a real good discussion about the schools, the medical facilities, the creating a bit of one-way road so that it would prevent a cut through. We said if those problems are there, they'll be our problems as well as yours. So we want to eliminate them. If you can foresee them, that's great. Because we're actually, what we're doing is coming to join this community. We're not imposing on it. And it's a very big difference. And it's remarkable how quickly people did get that message very clearly and realised, yes, this is part of, you know, variety and choice. Yes, it's different from what we're used to. But it is being done with the right motivations, in the sense that we are genuinely seeking to create a long-term community, which is a mix of uses and of tenures.
Okay, thank you. Roland, just looking at the questions up here, are you concerned that Project Ireland 2040 and its emphasis on balancing regional growth will be to the detriment of Dublin?
No.
Your answers are very emphatic and very short.
No, well, I'm
that's
not
a compliment, by the way.
I think regional growth is to be hoped for, and it would be of a huge benefit to the country as a whole, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be. In the past, because of political interference, again, they've tried to, you know, spur growth in one village in every parish in the country. It's stuff that doesn't work. So if we concentrate on trying to grow the main cities into major hubs like Cork, Galway, maybe Athlone, Limerick and Waterford, I think that would be a very good thing for the country as a whole, and I think it will also be a very good thing for Ireland. The one thing that is being seen internationally is the huge concentration into larger cities, and they're becoming more and more important to the extent now that people talk about cities rather than countries. And I think that's we're seeing that in Ireland as well. It's inevitable. And I think Dublin has a very bright future, and probably a brighter future if the regional development is successful too. But one way or the other, I think Dublin has a very bright future.
Okay, thank you. And Orla, have government initiatives such as the vacant site levy contributed or hindered development of housing in Dublin?
It's not directly my area. I think there are a lot of loopholes in the vacant site levies. So, and also given the rate of increase in land values in the last number of years, it's a very small percentage. So I don't know that it has been enough to shape behaviour in the way maybe that it was intended, or that there's plenty of get-out clauses in it. I think there is more that could be done, but more my area would be vacant buildings, actually. We have a huge amount of vacancy in our building stock. Even in the city centre, it's incredible the amount of available space which could be used for housing and free use for other uses, and there are barriers to that could be overcome very easily. I think it would be a very quick way of taking some of the immediate pressure out of the housing crisis, and also rather than putting money into temporary housing and paying twice, it would be a way of making permanent housing to take the pressure out rather than more stopgap measures.
Thank you. And then very quickly for James Patrick and Arlene, what's the one thing that's going to radically transform the development sector and make it more sustainable? Arlene?
I would say probably better partnership and collaboration between Dublin City Council, central government. You know, as an example, in Dublin, the state
owns a huge array of inner city sites and land. Orla alluded to that earlier. You know, there's lots of assets that, you know, could work better for the city. You know, we as developers could come in, take the risk, set up a public-private partnership type structure here. I know that's got very bad reputation here, but it's traditionally and historically been more focused on sort of an infrastructure provision type of model rather than a true partnership and collaboration. So I think that would definitely help to move things in the right direction here.
Thank you. Patrick?
Yeah, I'd echo that as well. I think it kind of answers your previous question. The vacant site levy, I think, is in the early stages, and so it has the potential to bring more land to the market, because those people who are essentially long land but short cash, it's encouraging them to bring stuff to the market, and that's a good thing. So that is a good chance. I think it needs more time. And then just for me to revert to type the word sustainable, one of the things in financing I've noticed in the international market is the emergence of green financing. So Dublin Landings is actually one of the first green loans done in Dublin, and it's for the development community. We're all looking at sustainability standards. I think the finance community has finally woken up that this is a good thing for their shareholders, and so they want to be able to say that the money they're putting into the market is being used for purposes which are sustainable. And I think that's a really good thing, and I think it's going to not radically change, but I certainly think the development community is doing it anyway, and this is another push.
Thank you. James?
Sustainability is a big word, isn't it? So there's three major pillars of it: economic, social, and environmental. And I think we, through the types of development, we focus on all three of those. And I think some of the, probably the economic and social have been touched on. I think in terms of the environmental, I think one of the things we've found over the last few years has been the introduction of modular construction has actually been a really environmentally sustainable thing to do. This is good quality long-term heavyweight construction, but it's reduced the construction site traffic, which was one of the main concerns to the existing residents in the areas where we're developing. Reduced that site traffic by 80%, which is enormous. It's reduced the construction waste by 80%, and it's provided, because you know the homes are built in factory conditions, it's provided some really top quality insulation, both thermal and acoustic. And I think that those sort of things may not be the number one factor in choices of what to do, but they've been really beneficial, and we'll end up with a much more sustainable and an enjoyable place to live, which will make people want to live there for longer.
Thank you. And Roland, given your answers have been succinct and emphatic, a last one for you. We're 6 years into this cycle. How long have we got?
Well, I've less time than some of the younger people in the audience, but look, as I said earlier, it's got to do with external factors, and I'm not going to predict what happens with trade wars or lack of them, or Brexit, hard or soft or whatever. So all I can say is the conditions on the ground at the moment are still very positive. There are huge risks out there, but what way the ball actually hops, I can't predict. If I could, I'd be a very wealthy person, but I can't predict. But I'm optimistic.
Good. Okay, an optimistic note to end on. So housing heavy and Brexit light. I hope that was the right balance. Question times in Manchester, Liverpool, Glasgow, Cambridge over the coming weeks and months. So tell friends, family and colleagues. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your questions. And please do thank our panel.